Today's Bible reading is from Joshua 22. The theme of the book of Joshua is about God's faithfulness to the promises that he made generations earlier to Abraham. Chapters 13 to 21 of Joshua are about the fulfillment of the gift of the land made to Abraham and his seed. And you can read in the final verses of chapter 21 that all the land has now been given to Israel, God has given them rest, and God has kept all his promises. So we're going to start at verse 9 of 22 today. Joshua has just sent the eastern tribes home to their land and reminded them to keep the commandment and the law of Moses. So Joshua 22, verse 9. So the Reubenites, the Gadites, and the half-tribe of Manasseh left the Israelites at Shiloh in Canaan to return to Gilead, their own land, which they had acquired in accordance with the command of the Lord through Moses. When they came to Gilaloth near the Jordan in the land of Canaan, the Reubenites, the Gadites, and the half-tribe of Manasseh built an opposing altar there by the Jordan. And when the Israelites heard that they had built the altar on the border of Canaan at Gilead near the Jordan on the Israelite side, the whole assembly of Israel gathered at Shiloh to go to war against them. So the Israelites sent Phinehas, son of Eleazar the priest, to the land of Gilead, to Reuben, Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh. With him they sent 10 of the chief men, one from each of the tribes of Israel, each the head of a family division among the Israelite clans. When they went to Gilead, to Reuben, Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh, they said to them, "The whole assembly of the Lord says, how could you break faith with the God of Israel like this? How could you turn away from the Lord and build yourselves an altar in rebellion against him now? Was not the sin of Peor enough for us? Up to this very day, we have not cleansed ourselves from that sin, even though a plague fell on the community of the Lord. And are you now turning away from the Lord? If you rebel against the Lord today, tomorrow he will be angry with the whole community of Israel. If the land you possess is defiled, come over to the Lord's land, where the Lord's tabernacle stands, and share the land with us. But do not rebel against the Lord or against us by building an altar for yourselves, other than the altar of the Lord our God. When Achan, son of Zerah, was unfaithful in regard to the devoted things, did not wrath come on the whole community of Israel? He was not the only one who died for his sin." Then Reuben, Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh replied to the heads of the clans of Israel, "The mighty one, God the Lord, the mighty one, God the Lord, he knows. And let Israel know, if this has been in rebellion or disobedience to the Lord, do not spare us this day. If we have built our own altar to turn away from the Lord and to offer burnt offerings and grain offerings or to sacrifice fellowship offerings on it, may the Lord himself call us to account. No, we did it for fear that someday your descendants might say to ours, 'What do you have to do with the Lord, the God of Israel? The Lord has made the Jordan a boundary between us and you. You Reubenites and Gadites, you have no share in the Lord.' So your descendants might cause ours to stop fearing the Lord. That's why we said, 'Let's get ready and build an altar, but not for burnt offerings or sacrifices. On the contrary, it's to be a witness between us and you and the generations that follow that we will worship the Lord at his sanctuary with our burnt offerings, sacrifices, and fellowship offerings. Then in the future, your descendants will not be able to say to ours, 'You have no share in the Lord.' And we said, if they ever say to us or to our descendants, we will answer, 'Look at the replica of the Lord's altar, which our ancestors built, not for burnt offerings and sacrifices, but as a witness between us and you. Far be it from us to rebel against the Lord and turn away from him today by building an altar for burnt offerings, grain offerings and sacrifices, other than the altar of the Lord our God that stands before his tabernacle.' When Phinehas the priest and the leaders of the community, the heads of the clans of the Israelites, heard what Reuben, Gad and Manasseh had to say, they were pleased. And Phinehas, son of Eleazar the priest, said to Reuben, Gad and Manasseh, 'Today we know that the Lord is with us, because you have not been unfaithful to the Lord in this matter. Now you have rescued the Israelites from the Lord's hand.' Then Phinehas, son of Eleazar the priest, and the leaders returned to Canaan from their meeting with the Reubenites and Gadites in Gilead and reported to the Israelites. They were glad to hear the report and praised God, and they talked no more about going to war against them to devastate the country where the Reubenites and the Gadites lived." And the second reading today is from Ephesians chapter 4. It's verse 15 and 16. Ephesians chapter 4, verse 15. Instead, speaking the truth in love, we will grow to become in every respect the mature body of him who is the head, that is Christ. From him the whole body, joined and held together by every supporting ligament, grows and builds itself up in love as each part does its work.
Well, hello everyone at Southern Cross Presbyterian Church. My name's Tim. I'm going to be spending a little bit of time with you today reflecting on this area of practical peacemaking, steps towards healthy relationships. Love to be with you in person today, but that's just not possible. So let's just concentrate on spending our time around God's word and reflecting together. Three passages today, just to understand a little bit of the dynamics of tense relationships, of conflict, how we can turn them into healthy relationships with one another. The three passages we're going to look at, first of all, a rather obscure and little bit of a strange story from the book of Joshua, right at the end of the book of Joshua and the conquest of the promised land. So I'll introduce that in a few moments. And we're just going to use that as an illustration of some of the dynamics of conflict and tense relationships. Most of our time we're going to spend in Matthew chapter 18, really reflecting on the Jesus way of doing reconciliation between people. And we're going to finish off with just a few reflections from Ephesians chapter 4 together. But before we begin, just a couple of things. I'd love you today to be thinking about real relationships in your own life. Have a think about any relationships which might be tense or in conflict at the moment, any relationships which you look back on in the past and think, wow, that didn't go quite so well as well as I'd hoped, or a relationship that you'd love to improve and develop into the future. So as we land things at the end of our session, I've got a few little questions and areas for you to reflect and think about in terms of those relationships, but keep them in mind as we work our way through the biblical passages and as we reflect on some of the dynamics of healthy relationships together. Let me just begin by reflecting on five reasons that Christians in particular find conflict or tense relationships a little bit challenging or even difficult to manage. The first of these, I think, is no surprise, and that is that we highly value love, unity, care and compassion for one another. Forgiveness is really important in our ethics and the way in which we relate to each other. And because those things are so important to us, when we come across situations and relationships or tense environments, we actually find that it goes right against our kind of our heart passion for what is good and what is whole. And it's very easy for us as Christians to confuse disagreement with each other and tension in relationships with a failure to love or a violation of peace, or we even sometimes spiritualize it and refer to things as sin. Now, sometimes these things do have sinful attitudes and sinful behaviors that come along with them, but disagreement itself and conflict itself is not an evil thing. In fact, it's a normal aspect of any human relationship. And one of the things that we need to do as Christians is learn how to understand the normality of conflict and learn thoughtful and careful ways to deal with it rather than suppressing it or rejecting it. So one of the tendencies we have as Christians is to deny conflict, to suppress it, and rather than embrace it and engage it in healthy ways, very often for Christians, we put it aside. This was certainly my experience growing up in a Christian family. I can't remember a major conflict in my family. It was certainly there, but it never got expressed and dealt with in an open way. Secondly, because we're not used to dealing with conflict and grappling with it in kind of careful and fairly robust sorts of ways, when it does break out, it often breaks out at a fairly high level and people get quite wounded and hurt. We don't always manage it wisely. Unfortunately, many Christians have not learned some of the skills of keeping their emotions carefully under control, remaining calm when things get tense, learning how to communicate clearly under pressure. Some of those skills that come from long times of practicing conflict, often as Christians, we're not particularly good at them. And so sometimes situations actually get out of hand and we do things that we never intended to do. We say things we never intended to say in the heat of the moment because we haven't learned some of the skills of dealing with conflict at the lower sorts of levels. To go along with that, lots of Christians, and maybe even some of you here today, actually carry quite painful and deep wounds for the ways in which you've been treated, even in Christian contexts, in Christian environments, in other church situations. People often simply leave a situation where they've been hurt and wounded rather than resolve it or work it through and simply go to a new place, and they bring that woundedness and that pain with them, which makes them all the more keen to shut down any conflict when they meet it in another place. So learning some of the skills to deal with conflict is actually really quite important. I suspect that Christians are a little bit conflict averse, which is one of the reasons that we wanted to talk about this subject today. Fourthly, I suspect after working with Christians for a long time in this area, that in fact the Christian church is not just conflict averse, it's conflict prone. And there's some pretty good reasons for that. The Christian church is one of the most effective groups in all of the social environments we have in any modern Western country for integrating people of quite diverse and different backgrounds, different educational backgrounds, different cultural backgrounds. We actually value diversity and we welcome people in from all kinds of different perspectives and backgrounds. And the Christian church is particularly good at that. Some recent research in the United Kingdom indicated that the church was the most likely group of people to successfully integrate people from other cultural backgrounds into English society. And I suspect the same might be true in Australia. So in learning to actually cope with diversity, one of the areas that is a challenge for us is conflict. People from different cultures deal with conflict very, very differently. We're also a group made up of volunteers, people who put a lot of time, a lot of effort and money into sharing together in a work that is really important to each of us. And that volunteer commitment is challenging to work. There's lots of conflict when volunteers actually work together. And Christians have very deeply held beliefs, things that are important to us that we value very deeply. And anytime we've got deep beliefs, we've got lots of hard work and people are putting in things themselves in a diverse environment, that's pretty well a recipe for conflict and for pretty tense relationships. Just a final thought before we dig into a couple of the Bible passages. Another reason that we are actually often subject to tension and conflict is that we have a mission of transformation. We want to see the gospel shared with people, which brings people into conflict, often with themselves, sometimes with God, as they grapple with this whole question of sin and repentance, of being open to the salvation that God freely offers people. Jesus actually told us that that would cause some conflict for people as we preach and as we share the gospel. And we know some of the challenges that we have as Christians in relating to our own society around some of the different values that are continuing to emerge in stronger ways in our very day and age. So we also have a mission inside ourselves to see us transformed and changed into the likeness of Christ. So all of those things bring a little bit of tension, a little bit of conflict as we're managing the situation together. So I'd like to reflect with you that I suspect the Christian church is conflict prone and also conflict averse. So what is conflict? How do we understand the dimensions of it? Let me just break it apart for you into a couple of processes, and then we're going to look at a couple of these Bible passages together. Conflict has three elements. First of all, there are differences between people that become apparent in all kinds of conversations, in all kinds of ways. We have different values, we have different ideas, we have different beliefs, different needs, different strategies, different goals. As we become clear that we have differences between each other around what's important to us, we then process what are we going to do with those differences. What's often the hidden aspect of conflict is what we believe those differences mean. Do those differences mean that you think I'm a less worthwhile person if I have a different view on something to you, or maybe I'm not as smart as you if I come up with a different way of doing something? It's what we assume those differences mean that then translate into our choices around behaviour. So if I come across a difference with you and that upsets me and makes me angry because I think somehow you are diminishing me or you are causing me some grief by having a different view than me, and I choose then to either withdraw or become angry with you, I'm adding a behaviour to a set of assumptions about a real difference that is there. And one of the things we learn as Christians is that we actually have choices around how we think about differences, whether we are open to understanding and reflecting on them, whether we can choose to have constructive and helpful behaviours, or whether we get caught up in things like anger and hatred losing our cool or withdrawing and backing away from people because of the understanding of what these differences mean. So let's go to the first of our passages in Joshua chapter 22. And this is a conflict story that's actually averted, and we'll just use it to understand a little bit of those conflict dynamics. I'll give you a chance in your home groups over the course of this week to dig into this passage with a little more depth, but just very quickly how it works. So what's happened is the nation of Israel have left Egypt. They've spent 40 years in the wilderness, and they're entering into the promised land. On the way in, 2.5 tribes saw some country on the other side of the Jordan, which wasn't the promised land itself. The Jordan River was the boundary, and they were entering into the promised land on the other side of the Jordan. But they saw some territory which was perfect for their flocks, for their settlements. And so they talked to Moses, and Moses said, yes, these 2.5 tribes can settle there and actually take up an inheritance on that side of the Jordan, even though it wasn't a part of the promised land. But they would need to go with their brothers and sisters across the Jordan, help to take the promised land, and then once it was taken, they could return home. So this has all happened. They 2.5 tribes on the other side of the Jordan, on the eastern side, have led the way, and they've actually been up front in all of the battles. The battles have been fought, and Joshua has dismissed them and allowed them to return to their home across the Jordan. So on arriving there, they have a think about what the meaning of this boundary, this Jordan River, is between the two nations, essentially. And so they decide that they're going to build a replica of the altar that is in front of the tabernacle in a place called Shiloh as a kind of marker on the edge of their country. And they hope that this will mean that anybody who comes will recognize them as Israelite people. It's the same altar, it's built on the same design, and this will mark them out as Israelites. And also it means that the boundary is not quite as clear, because there'll be the worship of God on both sides of the Jordan. But on hearing that they've built an altar, the Israelites who've settled in the promised land on the western side of the Jordan decide that this must be, you know, there's only one reason you build an altar, and that's you're going to offer sacrifices on it, use it for some sort of worship. This must mean that the other tribes are setting up an alternative worship system to the one system that was meant to be for everyone in the town of Shiloh, in the tabernacle. And God had said, this is the one place I'll put my name. Everyone must worship here. And so on hearing this, they all gather together, and they're about to go into civil war. So they've militarized themselves, and they're about to cross the Jordan and take the others out, because they feel that they are somehow now abandoning the worship of God. And so they've all amassed at Shiloh, and just before they set out, they sent a delegation across the river to find out and to question the others around what they're doing. When they arrive there, Phinehas the priest has got some pretty tough questioning going on. He accuses them of stepping away from the worship of the Lord, and threatens them with what is likely to unfold should they persist in that. But the eastern tribes hurriedly explain, actually, this is not what we meant by building an altar. What we meant was to mark this out. We were actually fearful that your descendants would say to our descendants, because you're on the other side of the Jordan, because you're outside of the promised land, essentially outside the boundaries of the promised land, you have no part in the worship of God. And so we wanted to build an altar to kind of mark the fact that we are believers. We are part of the nation of Israel. We do belong to you. And so once this is all unfolds and the situation is described, Phinehas and the leaders of the nation of Israel accept this explanation. They rejoice that nothing untoward needs to happen from here, and the situation is averted. So if we just have a look at this in conflict mode for a moment, The difference was another altar, an alternative altar. What the Eastern tribes meant by this was that it was meant to be a symbol of belonging, a symbol that they were staying faithful to God and wanted to be a part of Israel, even though there was a boundary, a difference down the middle line in the River Jordan. But the other tribes on the main part of nation of Israel, they saw this as an alternative to the worship of God, and it needed to be dealt with quickly. And so their method was to go to war and destroy, and they would have done that had there not been this opportunity to stop, to let things cool down, and to listen and to question and to discover what goes on. So what might we learn just from this kind of little story that takes place in the book of Joshua? First of all, whenever a difference surfaces, it's important to take some time to listen and understand before assuming that we know what that difference is about and what it means. A disaster was averted here simply by questioning and by listening. But you can also say, well, there's a little bit of fault on the other side too. Maybe they should have communicated clearly what their altar was all about. And there's a good lesson in that. Whenever we come up with something or a choice that we make or a decision that we run with that impacts other people, it's incredibly important to communicate clearly what we're thinking, what our motives are, what this is about, to avert the possibility of misunderstanding and assumptions. And it's always important to think through our behaviour and choose our responses wisely based on what we know and understand about the difference, and ensuring that we have our assumptions about a situation careful and right. Let's spend a few moments on Matthew chapter 18 and reflecting a little bit there on keeping our relationships healthy. Before we dig into Matthew 18 itself, just two verses that you'll be very familiar with, but just help us in understanding how to put relationships which are hurt and broken right. Matthew 5, 23 to 24. Therefore, if you're offering a gift at the altar, and there remember that your brother or sister has something against you, leave your gift there in front of the altar and go. First be reconciled to that person and then come and offer your gift. Matthew 7, again from the Sermon on the Mount, 3 to 5. Why do you look at the speck of sawdust in someone else's eye, but pay no attention to the plank in your own eye? How can you say, let me take the speck out of your own eye, when all the time there is a plank in your eye? You hypocrite, first take the plank out of your own eye, then you will see clearly to remove the speck from the other person's eye. Now, you've already heard Matthew chapter 18, but just to revisit the last two verses. Truly I tell you, says Jesus, whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven. Again, I tell you that if two or three of you agree on anything, then you ask for, it will be done for you by my Father in heaven. For where two or three come together in my name, there I am with them. So four principles around healthy relationships that come from the Gospel of Matthew. First of all, our relationships with each other are not separate from our relationship with God. So Matthew 5 makes that clear, that if we're offering a gift at the altar or engaged in worship and thanksgiving, and there remember that we've got a broken relationship with someone else, or the Spirit of God prompts us about those things, it's important to even to stop what we're doing, to reflect, to go and see if we can sort those things out. And this passage makes 100% clear that our relationship with God and our relationships with each other are two parts of our whole selves. We need to sort them both out. In fact, one influences the other. And so Matthew 18 says, what we bind on earth will be bound in heaven, what we loose on earth will be loosed in heaven. It's this same idea of the connection between the two things. And so God says, if you forgive your brother or your sister for what they've done for you, then that's something that is taken away from your account with me. But if you refuse to forgive your brother or your sister for what they've done, then God's hinting in here that God's saying, you and I are going to have to have a little chat about this down the track. This is an important issue that needs to be sorted out. I take note of what happens in your human relationships with each other. In other words, God takes the outcome of our conflict resolution seriously as a spiritual reality. Also, humble personal reflection needs to precede interpersonal resolution. So we need to stop and ask, is there a real offence here? Are we making something more? Are we making a mountain out of a molehill? Is there a real situation that we need to deal with? Is there a real brokenness that needs to be dealt with in here? And if there is, yes, let's deal with that. But let's be cautious about the fact that it's very easy to be critical or take offence at other people and not see what is going on for ourselves. And so that capacity for a little bit of careful, honest reflection is important in the processes of healthy relationships. And finally, and this is what something I absolutely love about this passage in Matthew 18, that here Jesus actually promises his presence where two or three are gathered together to sort out a situation. The context here is actually conflict resolution. It's not a small prayer meeting. And so Jesus, I'm sure he's there present with two or three gathered in prayer, but the purpose here, when two are gathered together, this is the individuals going to each other, or three, the individuals with a witness alongside them, going to each other to sort out a relationship. God promises to be present in that moment of attempted reconciliation. And I take great comfort from that. Jesus says on the Sermon on the Mount, blessed are the peacemakers, those who seek to sort things out between other people. And he promises to be present where two or three are willing to sort something out together. So what is the Matthew pathway? You've read this morning, and it's an important step. So first of all, I'd like to suggest that step number one is taking some time for personal reflection and asking, is God calling me to sort this situation out? Is there enough in this that requires me going to the other person to apologize or to seek an apology for a situation? I'd like to suggest there are certain things that we should learn to overlook. That's overlooking is probably something which is underrated in the Christian life. But if we wake up two or three mornings and it's on our heart and we're still hurting or offended or upset about something, and we're finding that it's impacting our relationship with a person, that's the time we need to take the initiative and go to see if we can sort something out with a brother or a sister. Step two is always go in private. This is not a time for engaging other people or particularly gossiping about the situation to others. This is a time to step in one-to-one and seek to sort the situation out. If someone comes to you and says they've got a problem with another person, the first question you ask is, "What have you been to them one-to-one?" Because if not, I can't really participate in this according to this passage. I can accompany you if you've already sought to go one-to-one and that's not succeeded, but I can't be a party to a discussion around a situation if you haven't first gone one-to-one to the other. Just a little exception on that. If you are genuinely seeking the wise counsel of another Christian around how to go about that one-to-one relationship, I would see that as a bit of an exception to that general rule, but certainly not to marshal support or to share your frustrations with other people. Step number three is having somebody else come along with you. This is a person to bear witness or even a skilled mediator to help sort out a situation. I do this fairly regularly for people who are seeking to resolve their relationships with each other. A mediator can actually provide an opportunity for both parties to be able to talk with each other in a safe environment. And I'd love to think that Christians were skilled in doing this, broad range of Christians able to minister and care for one another by being that point of just a skilled facilitator to help others put relationships right. Christians actually should be great at this. It should be something that we see as a regular ministry that we do for other people. Again, if both parties, again, are unable to resolve it with the help of a witness or a mediator, then the right thing to do, according to Jesus, is to place this in front of your leaders as a church. It doesn't mean put it on Facebook and advertise it to everyone. What it does mean is that take it to those who maybe have a shepherding responsibility over you, or who are elders of the church, or who are pastors of the church. Allow them to reflect with you, to consult with you, to see if you can come to a solution. And if that's impossible, One of the possibilities is that you place it in their hands for a decision and both parties agree to abide by that. It's what we call a kind of Christian area of arbitration. And it's a way to help relationships resolve. Again, this is the sort of thing that I've done for various people over a number of years, when they have confidence that they can be heard, they can be understood, but they can't resolve things themselves. Jesus then says, if this fails, and you're not able to accept the ruling of leaders in the church, you must treat these people like they're tax collectors and sinners. Now, what do you do with tax collectors and sinners? Well, you invite them around for dinner and preach the gospel to them. What you don't expect them to do is to be disciples of Jesus. So Jesus is saying, look, my disciples would solve things by going one-to-one, by going with another person, by submitting themselves to the church. If we get to the end of this process and a person has not been able to resolve a difference with the others, they're indicating that they're not able to function clearly as my disciples. I'm not saying that they're not disciples, they're just not able to operate in the way that Jesus would expect his disciples to operate. And so they need to really hear the message of God's grace and goodness once again. So let's just pick up a couple little thoughts from the book of Ephesians, and then we'll wind up our session together. I'd like to suggest to you that there are three fundamental elements that are important in this whole area of reconciliation with each other. The first is what we call truth-telling. This is the ability to be honest and open and clear with one another in a caring sort of way, speaking the truth in love. And this comes through clearly in Ephesians chapter 4, verses 15 and 16. And you'll have a chance to reflect on this over the coming week. God invites us to be truth tellers. Jesus says the truth will set you free. And what the foundation of good, healthy relationships is always honesty, openness, and truth. The second is doing what is right. And we call this justice seeking. That's where there's been hurt or offence or pain caused to others. It's seeking to put that right. And that's learning how to apologise, learning how to forgive one another, learning how to understand what it is that has actually happened here, and seeking, where possible, to do the right thing by putting situations right. So we call this justice seeking, doing what is right. But as Christians, we can't just live on truth and justice. We need God's grace. And this is where the willingness to forgive, to be gracious, to be kind, to be compassionate to one another is critically important. And so the third key area is grace giving. So let's just talk briefly about whether these situations can be put into practice. And this certainly happens in the Apostle Paul's teaching in Ephesians chapter 4. So let me go to just a couple of verses here as we conclude in our session together. Ephesians chapter 4 and verse 25. Each of you must put off falsehood and speak truthfully to his neighbour, for we are all members of one body. And verse 29, do not let any unwholesome talk come out of your mouths, only what is helpful for building others up according to their needs, that it might benefit those who listen. This is the willingness to be people of truth, honest, open, truthful, helpful, encouraging to one another, good, healthy communication with one another. It's a foundation of every healthy relationship. So can I encourage you, as you think about a situation in your own life, how can you take a step towards sharing the truth from your viewpoint, but also listening deeply and carefully to what another has to say? There's something called the closeness bias, and that is that very often with people that we are close to, we assume we know what they are thinking. We assume we know their perspective on things, when in actual fact, often we don't. And so learning to listen, particularly to those we are close to, is critically important. Verses 26 and 27 and 31. In your anger, do not sin. Don't let the sun go down while you're still angry. Do not give the devil a foothold. Get rid of all bitterness, rage and anger, brawling and slander, along with every form of malice. This is learning to do what is right, putting aside the loss of temper, the loss of emotional control, dealing with our negative emotions and conflict, not allowing resentment and bitterness to get a foothold, but being committed to doing what is good, just, and right in the lives of others. And finally, giving grace. This is responding to the prompting of the Holy Spirit, with whom we were sealed for the day of salvation or redemption, in verse 30 and in verse 32, be kind and compassionate to one another, forgiving each other, just as in Christ God forgave you. The word for forgiveness there is a word that is connected to the word for grace. All of us are profoundly and deeply thankful for all that Christ has done for us in making the way for us to have a healed relationship with God. The scriptures are full of the principle that out of our thankfulness and out of our sense of the wonder of God's love and acceptance of each of us, we are called to model that in the lives of other people. And so alongside of truth, which is pretty solid, and justice, which is doing right, is the willingness to be people of grace, to extend forgiveness, to extend kindness, to extend compassion to each other. So developing a grace-based response to others founded on God's forgiveness of us through Christ. So can I invite you, as I wrap up today, just to have a prayerful reflection around each of your relationships and ask, how can I take steps towards honest, open, thoughtful, constructive conversation with each other that shares the truth about who I am and what's going on for me, but also listens for the truth that is in other people's lives. Paul says in that verse, which is one of my favorites, I think verse 29, that even other people who listen to that kind of an exchange might benefit by it or be encouraged by it. Secondly, how can we do right? How can you think about the situations in the lives of other people that you're involved in, you're connected to do things which are good and right, and particularly where there's been pain or damage to others? How can we put those situations right? It's a worthy thing as a Christian to be able to think through the processes of apology, the processes of restoration. How can I put things right with another person? And finally, how do we develop that deep sense of grace, being willing and able to step into a situation where we can be people of kindness, people of compassion, people of forgiveness and graciousness to one another? They're the steps that I believe take us in the direction of healthy relationships, and it would be my prayer that you would know God's strength and God's empowering as you seek to make your relationships as healthy as possible.